What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss.
As we face a government that is active in its efforts to remove people's ability to make decisions about what happens in their own bodies, our guest today challenges even the framework that imposing any limits on abortion access means that we are not truly providing the room to choose. Dr. Shelley Sella is a board-certified OBGYN and the first woman to openly practice third trimester abortion care in the U.S. She recently retired from that work and compiled some of her deeply humanizing experiences, stories, reflections, and hopes into a brand new book called Beyond Limits, Stories of Third Trimester Abortion Care. Shelley, it's an honor to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
We have a lot to talk about with this book. And I want to mention up front, but to ask listeners to hold on to this for later, that you've had to deal with the politicization of abortion care. That experience has included being personally protested and threatened. And that's not to mention, of course, that as a result of the politicization of abortion, your own mentor, Dr. George Tiller, was assassinated for being a provider. Those are just a few ways you've dealt with the politics of abortion, but your actual experience in your book is focused on providing care. We can't not get into the politics, but I want to mostly save that for later. You write in your book that understanding third trimester abortions is the key to understanding all abortion care. So in the interest of understanding all abortion care, Shelley, what is a third trimester abortion? And for context, how is that medical process different from that of, say, a first or second trimester abortion?
Okay, well, thank you for asking that question, because I think people often don't know what's even talked about when we say third trimester abortion. So pregnancy is divided into trimesters. The first trimester is up to 12 to 14 weeks. The second trimester is 12 to 14 weeks, up to about 24 to 26 weeks. And the third trimester is from 24 to 26 weeks to term. Now, term is 40 weeks, but that's plus or minus 2 weeks. Each trimester involves different procedures. A first trimester involves either medication abortion, and that's, I think people are becoming increasingly familiar with that. Mm-hmm. That's taking pills, mifepristone and misoprostol, that in essence cause a miscarriage. And that can be administered either in a clinic or at home. And that can also be done through telehealth, telemedicine, increasingly. In the United States, that can be administered up through 11 weeks of pregnancy. In other countries, it's used, medication abortion is used even further in pregnancy. Second trimester abortion involves some preparation of the cervix, that's the bottom part of the uterus, preparing the body to use instruments to remove the pregnancy. And third trimester is a very different process. It's basically inducing labor. So it's an induction delivery of a stillborn. So I've just described three different procedures at three different phases of pregnancy.
It was helpful for me to understand better. You described that first and second trimester abortions are procedures, whereas third trimester abortion is, in your words, a process. It has more in common with midwifery and obstetrics than other abortion care. And I'm wondering, if now that we've gotten to third trimester abortion care, if you could describe some of the medical process that goes into it in a little bit more depth.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And I just want to go back a little bit to first trimester and second. That first trimester in a clinic is a very short procedure. It's a 5 to 7 minute procedure for removing the pregnancy. Right. And medication abortion, again, as I described, is a miscarriage, so it can take longer. And second trimester also involves preparing the body, but not as much as in the third trimester. So a second trimester abortion usually would take either 1 to 2 days. Third trimester takes place over several days, which doesn't mean that the person is in the clinic for that entire time, but it involves certain procedures done to help prepare the body for inducing labor. So the medical procedure in the third trimester takes longer. It takes longer to prepare the body to be ready to induce labor. And the induction is followed by a delivery of a stillborn. And so what I'm talking right now is the medical, the technical part of the procedure. But equally important is the emotional care of the person. And that was really integral for the care that I provided both in Wichita with Dr. Tiller and in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
And it was a powerful experience to read. I'm looking forward to hearing more about it in this interview. As we begin to get into third trimester abortion care, there are a lot of ideas and preconceptions that we have as a society about what might lead a person to seek third trimester abortion care. And a lot of it comes from judgment and judgment related to ideas that we've heard. Your book describes many pregnant people's stories and actual experiences of what types of things they went through to lead to that kind of a decision. I'm wondering if you can describe some reasons a pregnant person from your experience might choose to end a pregnancy after being pregnant for more than 24 to 26 weeks. This also seems like maybe a good place to describe and distinguish fetal anomalies and maternal indicators.
Yeah, I think that we rarely hear about third trimester abortions. But when we do, we hear about fetal indication patients. So why don't I start with that? That's a situation where the person finds out at some point in the pregnancy that their baby, and that is the word that they use to describe the pregnancy, that their baby has a condition that would mean either it would not survive birth or would die shortly after birth, or if it survived, would have a life of suffering, might require multiple surgeries, might require very, very intense medical care, and that the parents make the decision as parents that they don't want their child to suffer. So those are the stories that we hear about, if we are to hear about third trimester abortion care. But there are also other stories, and that in the book I call maternal indications. And those are for people who decide that an abortion is the best option for them, given their perhaps either their medical condition, that continuing the pregnancy would be dangerous to their physical health, or because of very difficult life circumstances. And I think both groups equally weigh the options for them and what is the best decisions for themselves, their families, and their child. And so for an example of a maternal indications that I talk about in the book is someone who was a victim of domestic violence. And she knew right away when she found out that she was pregnant, and she found out in the first trimester, she knew right away that she wanted an abortion. But it was really hard to leave her home to access an abortion. And she needed help from a relative. And when she got to the clinic, she didn't realize that she had to pay in cash, but she didn't have that. And then so she went back home. Then she had to run away from her home again to return to a clinic. And then there was a 24-hour waiting period. So she went back home. And so it was just constant barriers, hurdles that she had to jump through to access care while living in a violent situation. And by the time she was finally able to access care, she was in the third trimester. And actually, the stories that I talk about in the book, these are composite patients, all based on patients that I saw, but I formed composites. But that was a common story, and that was before Roe was overturned. And now, with the overturning of Roe, and so many states have banned abortion or have placed further restrictions, the barriers are even greater, and the barriers lead to delayed care, which leads to more patients seeking an abortion later in pregnancy. So I think, you know, I think there's this kind of misunderstanding about those who seek that care, that, again, that either they're fetal indications or they don't exist. But in fact, they do. And more patients are needing this care because of the restrictions and bans.
I want to ask one more question about maternal indicators before one follow-up about the fetal anomalies. In the example that you gave of a pregnant person who was living in a domestic violence situation and struggling to find a way to have access to abortion care, and that preventative access was from the person she lived with, not in particular the state, but then the state had limitations around a 24-hour return period and various other things. You wrote in your book that what these barriers failed to do was to dissuade women from ending their pregnancy. It seems like a significant amount of the pregnant people who seek abortion that long into a pregnancy would have preferred to get an abortion at an earlier time had that been accessible to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, no one decides, oh, I'm 8 weeks pregnant. I know that I want an abortion, and I think I'm just going to hang out at home for another 20 weeks and then get an abortion. I mean, that just has never happened. And I think that's another myth about those who seek third trimester abortion care. This lack of realization of what is going on for people in their lives. And people's lives are complicated. And I think that's one of the important points I make in the book. And people make the decision to end a pregnancy based on the reality of their lives. And they take a lot of factors into consideration. Their financial health, their housing, their ability to care for the children they already have, the safety of their home, their educational opportunities. There's so many factors that come into the decision whether to have an abortion or not, or whether to continue the pregnancy. And I think we need to recognize that and honor people's decisions.
And we're in conversation with Dr. Shelley Sella, the first woman to openly practice third trimester abortion care in the U.S. Her new book is called Beyond Limits, Stories of Third Trimester Abortion Care. Shelley, I want to go back for a moment to the fetal indicators. One word that you have not yet brought up in that context is viability. How we as a society think about fetal anomalies are often related to a concept of viability that has been legislated over and defined in a variety of ways. I'm wondering if you can bring us in to how a common concept of viability impacts these people who are pregnant, who discover that their baby or fetus has fetal anomalies, and how you challenge that idea of viability.
Thank you. That's a big question. So it's going to take a bit of a long answer, but I think I need to step backwards for a moment and look at the Roe decision, which said that viability was determined by the ability of the fetus to survive with or without artificial support. So what that looked at exclusively was the fetus, and could it survive? But survive, they meant live. And at that time, in 1973, when Roe was passed, viability was, using that criteria, was 28 to 29 weeks of pregnancy. Now, viability, again, using that criteria, is 23 to 24 weeks. But it just is looking at ability to survive. And it doesn't say for how long, or under what conditions. So at 23 to 24 weeks, about 40% of babies won't survive, and many will have long-lasting medical conditions. And again, as I said, it's just exclusively looking at the fetus's ability to survive. It doesn't look at all at the mother's, the pregnant person's ability, what the impact of the pregnancy will be on them. What will be the impact of this child on this person's life, on the child's life, on the family's life? And so what I talk about is a different definition of viability. Because I think ultimately, every person that I saw who came for an abortion had decided that this particular pregnancy in this particular moment was non-viable to them. And they looked at all the factors in their lives to determine viability. And I think that's what we need to be doing. We don't need to look at vague, supposedly objective, but certainly not notion of viability equals 23, 24 weeks, this kind of amorphous number, because it doesn't reflect the reality of people's lives. And the term viability is so mushy. In Alabama, viability is considered at conception. So rather than look at it from that point of view, I suggest that we look at it from the point of view of the person who is pregnant themselves, because they know best whether this pregnancy is viable or not.
And this is a big portion of why you say that understanding third trimester abortions is the key to understanding all abortion care, right? Because if we're talking about supporting a pregnant person's ability to make self-determined choices about their life, this is what we're really talking about.
Yes, and we're talking about it at all stages. Because those who come in the third trimester are the most desperate, are the most marginalized of people because of all the barriers and all the difficult situations that they've encountered. If we can say that we can care for those who are seeking abortion in the third trimester, under those circumstances, we can care for everyone, that everyone deserves access to compassionate and competent care. Everyone.
Thank you, Shelley. I want to go back now that we've learned what a third trimester abortion is, and we've learned a little bit about the viability side and a little bit also about the types of choices that pregnant people have faced in your experience as they come to decide to seek third trimester abortion care. I'm wondering if you can talk us through the process, and this reading your book was brand new to me, but through the process that a pregnant person generally might go through if they called your clinic and said that they were pregnant, they were more than 24 to 26 weeks, and said that they were seeking a third trimester abortion. Seems like from my read of your book that the counseling starts immediately.
Yes, and I think that's an extremely important part of the care. I do want to note, though, that what I wrote in my book is about my own experiences working in Wichita and Albuquerque. There are clinics in the country that offer this care now. That's different from when I first started, where there were so few. There are more clinics, and every clinic has their own protocol, own approach. So I can only talk about my own experiences. But how care was offered was recognizing how important the emotional care was to the patient, which started with their first phone call. Someone would call the clinic, and often the phone counselor was the first person that they had ever told what was going on for them. And the phone counselor would explain the procedure, but it was also an opportunity for the person to talk about what was going on for them. And often that person would call multiple times and talk to the same counselor. They felt reassured. They knew that they would be cared for kindly and competently. So that was the beginning of the counseling. Then when they came to the clinic, there was more counseling. In Albuquerque, there was counseling, individual counseling with a trained counselor and then with the physician. And in both Albuquerque and Wichita, Kansas, there were groups. That was an integral part of the process of an abortion. So again, it's not just the technical part. I explained to you that the technical part involved preparing the person's body to be able to undergo labor, to induce labor and deliver a stillborn. But accompanied by that was the emotional care. And so in the groups, they were divided into fetal indications and maternal indication patients. And it was basically a support group. So although it did also include some instruction what to expect, it also was an opportunity for people to sit in a room together who understood each other in a way that perhaps no one else could. And often as I said, when I talked about the person calling and never having shared their story, and we're talking to a phone counselor, certainly they had never sat in a room with other people who completely understood what they were going through. And it was a tremendous amount of support for people. People felt so relieved, I think. In the book, I talk about one situation which was so tragic to me, where in the maternal indications group, everyone had been raped. And they all talked about it. And they all got support from each other. And I think that that's very, very powerful and important for moving forward. So I felt like it wasn't just about ending the pregnancy. It was about giving people an opportunity to move forward in their lives. And these groups, I think, helped.
We've talked about some of the intake, some of the counseling. There's lots of room for pregnant people to ask questions and explore, make sure that they've considered various options as they made a decision to seek third trimester abortions. One additional element that your clinic provided that really hit me like a ton of bricks, and I had to stop and take some breaths from it, was the recovery room notebooks that were built not just to support those people through their own experience right then, but to pass on that wisdom. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about those recovery room notebooks and how you ended up with that idea.
Yeah, those notebooks were amazing. And the idea for that came from my colleague, Dr. Susan Robinson. After Dr. George Tiller was assassinated in church, a physician in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Curtis Boyd, invited Susan and me to come to his clinic that was providing first and second trimester abortions to set up a third trimester abortion clinic. And we then brought things that we had, or brought a philosophy, brought an approach that we had learned in Wichita, and we expanded on it. And so for Susan, what she brought were the notebooks. I think she had read about it. There were other clinics that were using the notebooks. And so she suggested that we have them. So that's how that started. And I think I brought a midwifery model of care that we expanded in Albuquerque. So the notebooks were this beautiful thing. We put them by each recliner chair in the recovery room. And it said on the outside something like, you know, feel free to write whatever you want for yourself and to share with others. And people wrote the most amazing and beautiful things. Some of it was along the lines of, you go, girl, you got this, you can do this, kind of encouraging other people. Like, I know this was hard, but you are strong and you can get through this, and we're here with you. And some of them were letters to God. And perhaps this is another misconception. Quite a few people that I cared for were religious. And some of them had to struggle with their religious beliefs and their absolute determination and knowledge that they needed to have an abortion. And so sometimes in the notebooks, there was kind of working through that. Please, God, forgive me. But this is what I absolutely needed to do. And I'm paraphrasing here because I can't remember the exact words, but there was one of something along the lines of, you know, thank God that he gave us the ability to think and make the decisions that's best for us. So it was in a way talking to themselves, kind of reconciling their religious beliefs with an abortion and talking to the next person. And people found them very, very helpful. Another thing about the notebooks is sometimes people would write letters to their baby, to their child, and sometimes they would name them. And they would say something like, to my child, I'm so sorry that I couldn't care for you in the way that I would have wanted to. But I know now that you will be in heaven with my grandmother, or with my mother, who will take care of you. Something like that, like this idea of, I wish I could have taken care of you, but my life circumstances are such that I can't. And I recognize that because I want you to have a good life, and I know that I can't provide that to you, for you.
And that's the voice of Dr. Shelley Sella, the first woman to openly practice third trimester abortion care in the U.S. Her new book is called Beyond Limits, Stories of Third Trimester Abortion Care. We've talked about so far what someone seeking a third term abortion might go through. You've made references to Los Angeles, to Wichita, to George Tiller. Let's talk about how you became a provider. Since, unfortunately, we're limited on time, I'm wondering if first you can briefly just talk us through your experiences in LA and then with Dr. Jim McMahon and then with Kate Boland in Santa Cruz. And we'll hold on George Tiller for just a moment.
Okay, well, my life history in a minute. I actually went to medical school to learn how to provide abortions. I had spent a summer at the Los Angeles Feminist Women's Health Center. This was in the late 70s. And that was my first exposure to abortion care. And that's why I went to medical school. After a year of internship in family medicine, I spent 2 years working with home birth midwives. And that was pivotal. That was in Santa Cruz, California, because it exposed me to a model of care that I was able to use in my practice in abortion care, one that really centers the pregnant person, centers their experience, centers the process, and all attention is focused on them rather than the demands of the institution. And intervention is done when necessary and not routinely. Following working with midwives, I did residency in OBGYN, and there I spent a few weeks with a third trimester provider. That was my first exposure. That was in Los Angeles with Dr. Jim McMahon. He unfortunately died in the 90s. So although we talked about maybe I would work with him once I finished residency, he did not live long enough for that to happen.
And that brings us to your introduction with Dr. George Tiller. In the book, you describe your first introduction to him where he was explaining his four rules of practice. And I'll read those briefly because they very strongly landed. The four rules are: first, a woman's body is smarter than the doctor. Second, time, patience, and the baby will come. Third, respect the woman's rhythm. And fourth, if you forget the second and third, remember the first: a woman's body is smarter than the doctor. You heard that framing and immediately were interested in him. Why was that framing important to you? And from there, talk about who George Tiller became for you.
Well, what happened when after he said those four sentences was I said, oh, that's midwifery. And within 5 minutes, he had offered me a job. I mean, that's the issue. That was what was so clear, like that his approach was a midwifery approach. As I said, within midwifery, there's really attention, strong attention to the process. And it's not just about the outcome. It's the whole process. And trusting the woman, trusting her trust in herself. Birth and even abortion care can be an empowering situation when the person is empowered. So creating an environment that supports the person as they're going through this process. That I got that right away from him, that was very important to him. And so that was kind of my immediate attraction to his practice. And I think that it went both ways because we talked about midwifery and it aligned with his approach as well. So it was kind of a meeting of the minds and a meeting of the hearts, I would say, which was there from the beginning. He was my mentor, and then we worked together for 7 years. I thought that would be my career. I would end my career in Wichita, Kansas with Dr. Tiller. But unfortunately and tragically, he was assassinated in church in 2009. He played a huge role in my life. We became very good friends. I felt very close to him, and not just kind of on a philosophical level, but on a friendship level, on a deep, deep heart level.
So you mentioned that he was assassinated, and at that assassinated in church. We haven't talked about the politics surrounding abortion and abortion provision in this country, but I think this is an important entry point. When you were working at his clinic in Wichita, Kansas, There were aggressive anti-abortion protesters outside every day, partially or maybe mostly led by a group called Operation Rescue. I'm wondering if you can talk about the impact of those anti-abortion protesters and some of what they did, including reporting you to the police as a murderer and notifying your neighbors that you were performing abortions as an attempt to make you scared of something, but of course also leading to the assassination of your mentor, Dr. George Tiller.
Yeah, I mean, I think the attacks were unrelenting in Wichita. Part of it was the protests, the daily, never-ending protests outside, the boycott of us in Wichita, for example. I talk about how taxi services wouldn't pick up patients going to the clinic. FedEx didn't want to deliver packages to us. We had to get a different waste management company. It was kind of on every level. The clinic was targeted, and not just the clinic, though. I mean, Dr. Tiller personally and his family, and not just them, but businesses that they frequented. Like even the dry cleaners were targeted because Dr. Tiller went to that dry cleaner. So it was kind of never ending. But that was just one level. And the other was the political attacks, which were also the kind of increasing restrictions on offering care, and the charges against him that were all eventually dropped, but were so unrelenting and so stressful. And complaints to the medical board by Operation Rescue against me, but much more towards against him. He was targeted nonstop. And what it felt like being there was, I felt like we were working in a bunker, and there was this, you know, just violence outside. But the atmosphere in the clinic was so different. It was really an atmosphere of love and compassion and kindness. That was inside. The hatred, the animosity, the vitriol, all of that was outside. But it was there, and it certainly grew stronger and stronger and culminated in his assassination.
A lot of that hatred and vitriol that was outside is also very present in our political system and has influenced a lot of how many of us think about abortion care and why someone might turn to abortion or what their experience might be, even in ways that we might not be thinking of as super political. I'm wondering if we can talk about some of the questions that are raised partially as a result of these kind of anti-abortion zealots. One of the things that you wrote is that you've never heard a maternal indicator patient say that they regret having an abortion. We often hear about, oh, but what if they'll regret it later? How do you respond?
Yeah, regret is a interesting concept. One person said, I regret I didn't use birth control. You know, as simple as that. But it's regret for the situations that brought me to the clinic. It wasn't regret for the abortion. The abortion is what saved my life, or it is what's going to save my life. It's what's going to allow me to move forward in my life. I don't regret that. I regret being in an abusive situation. I regret that this country doesn't offer housing. And interestingly, there's a book called Relinquish that was written by Gretchen Sison, and she writes about adoption from the perspective of birth mothers. It's a nonfiction book. And there, what's interesting to me is there's an overwhelming feeling of regret of relinquishing the baby for adoption. So that's very, very different from the patients that I saw. So yeah, it's interesting how there's that's a myth, really, that women regret their abortion. They don't. They're relieved. The overwhelming feeling is one of relief.
And two more questions that you address in your book, and I'll do this one first because you just kind of made a reference to it, but the question would be, isn't adoption a viable alternative, especially in the third trimester?
Yeah, I think that is one of the most common questions that I've been asked. And I think that question trivializes the experience of people. Well, For one thing, I think we need to remember the risks of childbirth in the United States. The maternal mortality rate in the U.S. is obscenely high, and especially for Black women. So we need to just even think of physically what that means to coerce people to continue a pregnancy and give birth at term. But beyond that, patients that I cared for had considered adoption before they came to the clinic and had decided that that was not the decision for them. For some, they had had their own experience with adoption. I talk about someone who had relinquished her baby in the past, and it was just a horrible experience for her. It was something that she deeply regretted. And while she knew she couldn't care for a child, she did not want to go through that again. And then another thing that I was really struck with when I talked to patients was their concern for their child, for this child. And they worried about it. And they felt like, and this was especially teenagers, and it's teenagers that we often hear about, oh, why doesn't she just give the baby up for adoption? You know, she's young, she's healthy, this baby will be fine. But they have such deep concern, and they worry that their child will grow up and will feel abandoned. They worry that it will feel like no one cared for them. And they just worry that it won't be cared for well. And that thought is just intolerable for them. And so it really opened my eyes to their deep concern and wanting the best and knowing that they couldn't offer that, and yet not wanting to put their child out into the world, because they had no idea how it would be. So it was, they didn't know what kind of life it would have. They didn't know if it would be cared for adequately. And as I said, that was just intolerable to them. One person I write about in the book, she said to me, you know, at least this way, I'll know that it will be in heaven. I found that so poignant, you know?
Yeah. So Shelley, we're going to have to wrap up the conversation. There's so many more questions that you do address in the book, and those answers are incredibly thoughtful. But I want to end with a question about the political climate and what you imagine for what it could mean to create abortion care access beyond limits. You suggest that while the Dobbs Supreme Court decision that removed the right to abortion access certainly was bad, that those of us who support access to abortion care should respond with a different paradigm rather than just to reintroduce the Roe law as it existed before Dobbs. I'm wondering if you can maybe touch on what's wrong with Roe, but also what do you think of that could offer access to care, but within a different paradigm?
So as you said, it was definitely not a good thing that Roe was overturned. The Dobbs decision has been horrific. The ramifications of the Dobbs decision have been horrific for so many people in this country. But the fact that Roe is overturned is an opportunity to move forward and not look backwards. In other words, not looking back at Roe and saying we should restore Roe, because Roe was problematic. Roe, from the beginning, had viability bans. And with time, rather quickly, more and more restrictions were placed on Roe. So I think we need to think beyond that, beyond Roe, beyond gestational limits, because we recognize that gestational limits are arbitrary and they don't reflect the reality of people's lives. And so if we can move to a model where we acknowledge and honor the pregnant person's ability to determine that this pregnancy is non-viable or viable. And if they determine it's non-viable, to offer them abortion care that addresses their emotional and spiritual and physical needs, and that moves beyond gestational limits.
And I think that is the right note to end on, Shelley. You argued in your book, and we started with it, so I want to say one more time, repeating it, that understanding third trimester abortions is the key to understanding all abortion care. Thank you for joining us, Shelley.
Thank you.
And that was the voice of Shelley Sella, a board-certified OBGYN and the first woman to openly practice third trimester abortion care in the U.S. She recently retired from that work and compiled some of her deeply humanizing experiences, stories, and hopes into a brand new book called Beyond Limits, Stories of Third Trimester Abortion Care. You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a world where all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is co-hosted by me, Jesse Strauss, and Kat Brooks, and produced by me as well. Our show theme music is from Steve Raskin. Feel free to hit us up about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media. That's at lawanddis, D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you stream podcasts by searching for Law & Disorder with Kat Brooks. You can also find our content live on KPFA Radio or streaming at kpfa.org in the 8 a.m. Pacific hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by listeners, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.